The Running Man, by Stephen King, writing as Richard Bachman, continued, Disc 6. Minus 25, and counting. The two troopers on roadblock duty at the eastern entrance of the jetport watched the huge liner fling itself down the runway, gaining speed. Its lights blinked orange and green in the growing dark, and the howl of its engines buffeted their ears.
He's going. Christ, he's going. Where?
Said the other. They watched the dark shape as it separated from the ground. Its engines took on a curiously flat sound, like artillery practice on a cold morning. It rose at a steep angle, as real and as tangible and as prosaic as a cube of butter on a plate, yet improbable with flight.
You think he's got it?
Hell, I don't know.
The roar of the jet was now coming to them in falling cycles.
I'll tell you one thing, though.
The first turned from the diminishing lights and turned up his collar.
I'm glad he's got that bastard with him, that McCone.
Can I ask you a personal question?
As long as I don't have to answer it.
Would you like to see him pull it off? The trooper said nothing for a long time. The sound of the jet faded, 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 until it disappeared into the underground hum of nerves at work. Yes.
Do you think he will?
A crescent smile in the darkness.
My friend, I think there's going to be a big boom.
Minus 24, and counting. The earth had dropped away below them. Richard stared out wonderingly, unable to drink his fill. He'd slept through the other flight, as if in wait for this one. The sky had deepened to a shade that hung on the borderline between royal velvet and black. Stars poked through the hesitant brilliance. On the western horizon, the only remnant of the sun was a bitter orange line that illuminated the dark earth below not at all. There was a nestle of lights below he took to be dairy.
Mr. Richards?
Yes.
He jumped in his seat as if he'd been poked.
We're holding in a pattern right now. That means we're describing a large circle above the void jetport. Instructions?
Richards thought carefully. It wouldn't do to give too much away.
What's the absolute lowest you can fly this thing?
There was a long pause for consultation.
We could get away with 2,000 feet,
Holloway said cautiously.
It's against NSA's regs, but
never mind that,
Richard said.
I have to put myself in your hands to a certain extent, Mr. Holloway. I know very little of flying, and I'm sure you've been briefed on that, but please remember that the people who are full of bright ideas about how to bamboozle me are all on the ground and out of danger. If you lie to me about anything, and I find out,
nobody up here is going to do any lying,
Holloway said.
We're only interested in getting this thing back down the way it went up.
Okay.
Good.
He gave himself time to think. Amelia Williams sat rigidly beside him, her hands folded in her lap.
Go due west, he said abruptly. 2,000 feet. Point out the sights as we go along, please.
The sights?
What we're going over, Richard said.
I've only flown once before.
Oh.
Holloway sounded relieved. The plane banked beneath their feet, and the dark sunset line outside the window tilted on its ear. Richards watched, fascinated. Now it gleamed aslant the thick window, making odd, fugitive sungleams just beyond the glass. We're chasing the sun, he thought.
Isn't that amazing?
It was 6:35. Minus 23, and counting. The back of the seat in front of Richards was a revelation in itself. There was a pocket with a safety handbook in it.
In case of air turbulence, fasten your belt. If the cabin loses pressure, pull down the air mask directly over your head.
In case of engine trouble, the stewardess will give you further instructions. In case of sudden explosive death, hope you have enough dental fillings to ensure identification. There was a small freebie set into the seat panel at eye level. A metal card below it reminded the viewer that channels would come and go with a fair degree of speed. A touch control channel selector was provided for the hungry viewer. Below and to the right of the freebie was a pad of airline stationery and a GA stylus on a chain. Richards pulled out a sheet and wrote clumsily on his knee, "Odds are 99 out of 100 that you're bugged. Shoe mic or hair mic, maybe mesh transmitter on your sleeve. McCone listening and waiting for you to drop the other shoe, I bet. In a minute, have a hysterical outburst and beg me not to pull the ring. It'll make our chances better. You game?" She nodded, and Richards hesitated, then wrote again, "Why did you lie about it?" She plucked the stylus out of his hand and held it over the paper on his knee for a moment, and then wrote, "Don't know. You made me feel like a murderer. Wife. And you seem so." The stylus paused, wavered, and then scrawled, "Pitiful." Richards raised his eyebrows and grinned a little. It hurt. He offered her the stylus, but she shook her head mutely. He wrote, "Go into your act in about 5 minutes." She nodded, and Richards crumpled the paper and stuffed it into the ashtray and embedded in the armrest. He lit the paper. It puffed into flame and blazed brightly for a moment, kindling a tiny reflective glow in the window. Then it collapsed into ashes, which Richards poked thoughtfully. About 5 minutes later, Amelia Williams began to moan. It sounded so real that for a moment, Richards was startled. Then it flashed across his mind that it probably was real. "Please don't," she said. "Please don't make that man have to try you. I never did anything to you. I want to go home to my husband. We have a daughter, too. She's 6. She'll wonder where her mommy is." Richards felt his eyebrow rise and fall twice in an involuntary tick. He didn't want her to be that good. Not that good. "He's dumb," he told her, trying not to speak for an unseen audience, "but I don't think he's that dumb." "It will be all right, Mrs. Williams." "That's easy for you to say. You've got nothing to lose." He didn't answer her. She was so patently right. Nothing, anyway, that he hadn't lost already. "Show it to him," she pleaded. "For God's sake, why don't you show it to him? Then he'd have to believe you. Call off the people on the ground. They're tracking us with missiles. I heard him say so." "I can't show him," Richard said. "To take it out of my pocket would mean putting the ring on safety or taking the full risk of blowing us up accidentally. Besides," he added, injecting mockery into his voice, "I don't think I'd show him if I could. He's the maggot with something to lose. Let him sweat it."
"I don't think I can stand it," she said dully. "I almost think I'd rather joggle you and have it over. That's the way it's going to end anyway, isn't it?"
"You haven't," he began, and then the door between first and second was snapped open, and McCone half strode, half lunged through. His face was calm, but beneath the calm was an odd, sheeny look, which Richards recognized immediately. The sheen of fear, white and waxy and glowing.
"Mrs. Williams," he said briskly, "coffee, if you please, for 7. You'll have to play stewardess on this flight, I'm afraid."
She got up without looking at either of them.
"Where?"
"Forward,"
McCone said smoothly.
"Just follow your nose."
He was a mild, blinking sort of man, and ready to lunge at Amelia Williams the moment she showed a sign of going for Richards. She made her way up the aisle without looking back. McCone stared at Richards and said,
"Would you give us up if I could promise you amnesty, pal?"
"Pal? That word sounds really greasy in your mouth," Richards marveled.
He flexed his free hand, looked at it. The hand was caked with small runnels of dried blood, dotted with tiny scrapes and scratches from his broken ankle hike through the southern Maine woods.
"Really greasy. You make it sound like 2 pounds of fatty hamburger cooking in the pan, the only kind you can get at the welfare stores in Co-op City."
He looked at McCone's well-concealed pot.
"That now? That looks more like a steak cut. Prime cut. No fat on prime cut except that crinkly little ring around the outside, right?"
"Amnesty,"
McCone repeated.
"How does that word sound?"
"Like a lie,"
Richard said, smiling. Like a fat fucking lie. Don't you think I know you're nothing but the hired help?
McCone flushed. It was not a soft flush at all. It was hard and red and brick-like.
It's going to be good to have you on my home court, he said. We've got high-impact slugs that will make your head look like a pumpkin dropped on a sidewalk from the top floor of a skyscraper. Gas-filled. They explode on contact. A gut shot, on the other hand.
Richard screamed, "Here it goes! I'm pulling the ring!"
McCone screeched. He staggered back two steps. His rump hit the well-padded arm of seat number 95 across the way. He overbalanced and fell into it like a man into a sling, his arms flailing the air around his head in crazed warding-off gestures. His hands froze about his head like petrified birds, splay-fingered. His face stared through their grotesque frame like a plaster death mask on which someone had hung a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles for a joke. Richards began to laugh. The noise of it was cracked at first, hesitant, foreign to his own ears. How long it had been since he had had a real laugh, an honest one, the kind that comes freely and helplessly from the deepest root of the stomach. It seemed to him that he had never had one in his whole gray, struggling, earnest life, but he was having one now.
You bastard.
McCone's voice had failed him. He could only mouth the words. His face was twisted and scrunched like the face of a badly used teddy bear. Richards laughed. He held onto one arm of his seat with his free hand and just laughed and laughed and laughed. -22 and counting. When Holloway's voice informed Richards that the plane was crossing the border between Canada and the state of Vermont, where Richards supposed he knew his business, he himself could see nothing but darkness below them, interrupted by occasional clusters of light, he set his coffee down, carefully, and said, "Could you supply me with a map of North America, Captain Holloway? Physical or political?" A new voice cut in. The navigators, Richards supposed. Now he was supposed to play obligingly dumb and not know which map he wanted, which he didn't. "Both," he said flatly. "Are you going to send the woman up for them? What's your name, pal?" The hesitant pause of a man who realizes with sudden trepidation that he's been singled out. "Donahue." "You got legs, Donahue. Suppose you trot them back here yourself." Donahue trotted them back. He had long hair combed back greaser fashion, and pants tailored tight enough to show what looked like a bag of golf balls at the crotch. The maps were encased in limp plastic. Richards didn't know what Donahue's balls were encased in. "I didn't mean the mouth off," he said unwillingly. Richards thought he could peg him. Well-off young men with a lot of free time often spent much of it roaming the shabby pleasure areas of the big cities, roaming in well-heeled packs, sometimes on foot, more often on choppers. They were queer stompers. Queers, of course, had to be eradicated. Save our bathrooms for democracy. They rarely ventured beyond the twilight pleasure areas into the full darkness of the ghettos. When they did, they got the shit kicked out of them. Donahue shifted uneasily under Richard's long gaze. "Anything else? You a queer stomper, pal? Huh? Never mind. Go on back. Help them fly the plane." Donahue went back at a fast shuffle. Richards quickly discovered that the map with the towns and cities and roads was the political map. Pressing one finger down from Derry to the Canada-Vermont border in a western-reaching straight edge, he located their approximate position. "Captain Holloway?"
"Yes?"
"Turn left."
"Huh?"
Holloway sounded frankly startled.
"South. I mean due south. And remember."
"I'm remembering," Holloway said. "Don't worry."
The plane banked. McCone sat hunched in the seat he had fallen into, staring at Richards with hungry, wanting eyes. -21 and counting. Richards found himself drifting in and out of a daze, and it frightened him. The steady drone of the engines were insidious, hypnotic. McCone was aware of what was happening, and his leaning posture became more and more vulpine. Amelia was also aware. She cringed miserably in a forward seat near the galley, watching them both. Richards drank two more cups of coffee. Not much help. It was becoming increasingly difficult to concentrate on the coordination of his map and Holloway's toneless commentary on their outlaw flight. Finally, he drove his fist into his side, where the bullet had taken him. The pain was immediate and intense, like a dash of cold water in the face. A whistling, half-whispered screech issued from either side of his clenched mouth, like stereo. Fresh blood wet his shirt and sieved through onto his hand. Amelia moaned.
"We'll be passing over Albany in about 6 minutes," Holloway said. "If you look out, you'll see it coming up on your left."
"Relax," Richard said to no one. To himself. "Relax. Just relax. God, will it be over soon?" "Yes, quite soon." It was 7:45. -20 and counting. It could have been a bad dream, a nightmare that had crawled out of the dark and into the unhealthy limelight of his half-awake mind. More properly, a vision or a hallucination. His brain was working and concentrating on one level, dealing with the problem of navigation and the constant danger of McCone. On another, something black was taking place. Things were moving in the dark. Track on. Positive. Huge, whining servo mechanisms turning in the dark, in the night. Infrared eyes glowing in unknown spectrums. Pale green foxfire of dials and swinging radar scopes. "Lock. We have a lock." Trucks rumbling along backcountry roads and on triangulated flatbeds 200 miles apart. Microwave dishes swing at the night sky. Endless streams of electrons fly out on invisible bat wings. Bounce. Echo. The strong blip and the fading afterimage lingering until the returning swing of light illuminates it in a slightly more southerly position.
"Solid?" "Yep. 200 miles south of Newark. It could be Newark. Newark's on red. Also southern New York."
"Executive hold still in effect?"
"That's right. We had him dead bang over Albany. Be cool, pal."
Trucks thundering through closed towns where people look out of cardboard-patched windows with terrified, hating eyes, roaring like prehistoric beasts in the night.
"Open the holes."
Huge grinding motors slide huge concrete dunce caps aside, shunting them down gleaming steel tracks. Circular silos like the entrances to the underworld of the Morlocks. Gasps of liquid hydrogen escaping into the air.
"Tracking. We are tracking. Newark."
"Roger, Springfield. Keep us in."
Drunks sleeping in alleys wake foggily to the thunder of the passing trucks and stare mutely at the slices of sky between close-leaning buildings. Their eyes are faded and yellow. Their mouths are dripping lines. Hands pull with senile reflex for newsies to protect against the autumn cold. But the newsies are no longer there. The Freevee has killed the last of them. Freevee is king of the world. Hallelujah! Rich folks smoke dokes. The yellow eyes catch an unknown glimpse of high, blinking lights in the sky. Flash, flash. Red and green, red and green. The thunder of the trucks is faded, ramming back and forth in the stone canyons like the fists of vandals. The drunks sleep again.
Bitchin'. "We got him west of Springfield."
"Go, no go, 5 minutes.
"From Harding?"
"Yes."
"He's bracketed and braced."
All across the night, the invisible bat wings fly, drawing a glittering net across the northeast corner of America. Servos controlled by General Atomics computers function smoothly. The missiles turn and shift subtly in 1,000 places to follow the blinking red and green lights that sketch the sky. They're like steel rattlesnakes, filled with waiting venom. Richard saw it all. and functioned even as he saw it. The duality of his brain was oddly comforting in a way. It induced a detachment that was much like insanity. His blood-crusted fingers followed their southward progress smoothly. Now south of Springfield, now west of Hartford, now... Tracking. -19 and counting.
Mr. Richards?
Yes.
We're over Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, Richards said. I've been watching. Holloway? Holloway didn't reply, but Richards knew he was listening. They've got a bead drawn on us all the way, don't they?
Yes,
Holloway said. Richards looked at McCone. I imagine they're trying to decide if they can afford to do away with their professional bloodhound here. Imagine they'll decide in the affirmative. After all they have to do is train a new one. McCone was snarling at him, but Richards thought it was a completely unconscious gesture, one that could probably be traced all the way to McCone's ancestors, the Neanderthals who had crept up behind their enemies with large rocks rather than battling to the death in the honorable but unintelligent manner.
When do we get over open country again, Captain?
We won't. Not on a due south heading. We will strike open sea after we cross the offshore North Carolina drilling derricks, though.
Everything south of here is a suburb of New York City?
That's about the size of it,
Holloway said.
Thank you.
Newark was sprawled and groined below them like a handful of dirty jewelry thrown carelessly into some lady's black velvet vanity box.
Captain,
wearily.
Yes.
You will now proceed due west. McCone jumped as if he'd been goosed. Amelia made a surprised coughing noise in her throat.
West?
Holloway asked. He sounded unhappy and frightened for the first time.
You're asking for it, going that way. West takes us over pretty open country. Pennsylvania between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh is all farm country. There isn't another big city east of Cleveland.
Are you planning my strategy for me, Captain?
No, I do west,
Richards repeated curtly. Newark swung away beneath them.
You're crazy,
McCone said.
They'll blow us apart.
With you and five other innocent people on board? This honorable country?
It will be a mistake,
McCone said harshly.
A mistake on purpose.
Don't you watch the National Report? Richards asked, still smiling. We don't make mistakes. We haven't made a mistake since 1950.
Newark was sliding away beneath the wing. Darkness took its place.
You're not laughing anymore, Richard said.
-18 and counting. A half hour later, Holloway came on the voice comm again. He sounded excited.
Richards, we've been informed by Harding Red that they want to beam a high-intensity broadcast at us. From Games Federation. I was told you would find it very much worth your while to turn on the freebie.
Thank you. He regarded the blank freebie screen and almost turned it on. He withdrew his hand as if the back of the next seat with its embedded screen was hot. A curious sense of dread and deja vu filled him. It was too much like going back to the beginning. Sheila with her thin, worked face, the smell of Mrs. Jenner's cabbage cooking down the hall, the blare of the games, treadmill to Bucks, swim the crocodiles, Kathy's screams. There could never be another child, of course, not even if he could take all this back, withdraw it, and go back to the beginning. Even the one had been against fantastically high odds.
Turn it on, McCone said. Maybe they're going to offer us a deal.
Shut up, Richard said. He waited, letting the dread fill him up like heavy water. The curious sense of presentiment. He hurt very badly. His wound was still bleeding, and his legs felt weak and far away. He didn't know if he could get up to finish this charade when the time came. With a grunt, Richards leaned forward again and pushed the on button. The freebie sprang to incredibly clear, amplified signal life. The face that filled the screen, patiently waiting, was very black and very familiar. Dan Killian. He was sitting at a kidney-shaped mahogany desk with a game symbol on it.
"Hello there," Richard said softly.
He could have fallen out of his seat when Killian straightened up, grinned, and said,
"Hello there yourself, Mr. Richards."
Minus 17, and counting.
"I can't see you," Killian said, "but I can hear you. The jet's voice comm is being relayed through the radio equipment in the cockpit. They tell me you're shot up."
"It's not as bad as it looks," Richard said. "I got scratched up in the woods."
"Oh, yes," Killian said. "The famous run through the woods. Bobby Thompson canonized it on the air just tonight, along with your current exploit, of course. Tomorrow those woods will be full of people looking for a scrap of your shirt or maybe even a cartridge case."
"That's too bad," Richard said. "I saw a rabbit."
"You've been the greatest contestant we've ever had, Richards. Through a combination of luck and skill, you've been positively the greatest. Great enough for us to offer you a deal."
"What deal?"
"Nationally televised firing squad?" "This plane hijack has been the most spectacular, but it's also been the dumbest. Do you know why?" "Because for the first time, you're not near your own people. You left them behind when you left the ground. Even the woman that's protecting you. You may think she's yours. She may even think it, but she's not. There's no one up there but us, Richards. You're a dead duck. Finally."
"People keep telling me that, and I keep drawing breath."
"You've been drawing breath for the last 2 hours, strictly on Games Federation say-so. I did it. And I'm the one that finally shoved through the authorization for the deal I'm going to offer you. There was strong opposition from the old guard. This kind of thing has never been done. But I'm going through with it. You asked me who you could kill if you could go all the way to the top with a machine gun. One of them would have been me, Richards. Does that surprise you?"
"I suppose it does. I pegged you for the house, nigger." Killian threw back his head and laughed, but the laughter sounded forced. The laughter of a man playing for high stakes and laboring under a great tension.
"Here's the deal, Richards. Fly your plane to Harding. There will be a games limo waiting at the airport. An execution will be performed. A fake. Then you join our team."
There was a startled yelp of rage from McCone.
"You black bastard!"
Amelia Williams looked stunned.
"Very good," Richard said. "I knew you were good, but this is really great. What a fine used car salesman you would have made, Killian."
"Did McCone sound like I was lying?"
"McCone is a fine actor. He did a little song and dance at the airport that could have won an Academy Award."
Still, he was troubled. McCone's hustling away of Amelia for coffee when it appeared she might trip the Irish. McCone's steady, heavy antagonism. They didn't fit. Or did they? His mind began to pinwheel.
"Maybe you're springing this on him without his knowledge, counting on his reaction to make it look even better."
Killian said,
"You've done your song and dance with a plastic explosive, Mr. Richards.
We know.
Know that you are bluffing. But there is a button on this desk, a small red button, which is not a bluff. 20 seconds after I push it, that plane will be torn apart by surface-to-air Diamondback missiles carrying clean nuclear warheads. The Irish isn't fake either."
But there was a curdled taste in his mouth. The bluff was soured.
"Oh, it is. You couldn't get on a Lockheed GA plane with a plastic explosive, not without tripping the alarms. There are 4 separate detectors on the plane, installed to foil hijackers. A 5th was installed in the parachute you asked for. I can tell you that the alarm lights in the void field control tower were watched with great interest and trepidation when you got on. The consensus was that you probably had the Irish. You've proved so resourceful all the way up the line that it seemed like a fair assumption to make. There was more than a little relief when none of those lights went on. I assume you never had the opportunity to pick any up. Maybe you never thought of it until too late.
Well, does it matter? It makes your position worse, but...
McCone was suddenly standing beside Richards.
Here it goes, he said, grinning. Here is where I blow your fucking head off, donkey.
He pointed his gun at Richards' temple. -16 and counting.
You're dead if you do, Killian said.
McCone hesitated, fell back a step and stared at the freebie unbelievingly. His face began to twist and crumple again. His lips writhed in a silent effort to gain speech. When it finally came, it was a whisper of thwarted rage.
I can take him! Right now, right here! We'll all be safe, we'll...
Wearily, Killian said,
You're safe now, you goddamned fool. And Donahue could have taken him, if we wanted him taken. This man is a criminal!
McCone's voice was rising.
He's killed police officers, committed acts of anarchy and air piracy. He's publicly humiliated me and my department.
Sit down, Killian said, and his voice was as cold as the deep space between planets.
It's time you remembered who pays your salary, Mr. Chief Hunter.
I'm going to the council president with this.
McCone was raving now. Spittle flew from his lips.
You're going to be chopping cotton when this is over, Nig. You goddamn worthless night-fighting son of a bitch!
Please throw your gun on the floor, a new voice said. Richards looked around, startled. It was Donahue, the navigator, looking colder and deadlier than ever. His greased hair gleamed in the cabin's indirect lighting. He was holding a wire-stock Magnum Springsteen machine pistol, and it was trained on McCone.
Robert S. Donahue, old-timer. Games Council Control. Throw it on the floor.
-15 and counting. McCone looked at him for a long second, and then the gun thumped on the heavy pile of the carpet.
You?
I think we've heard all the rhetoric we need, Donahue said. Go back into second class and sit down like a good boy.
McCone backed up several paces, snarling futilely. He looked to Richards like a vampire in an old horror movie that had been thwarted by a cross. When he was gone, Donahue threw Richards a sardonic little salute with the barrel of his gun and smiled.
He won't bother you again.
You still look like a queer stomper, Richards said evenly.
The small smile faded. Donahue stared at him with sudden, empty dislike for a moment, and then went forward again. Richards turned back to the freebie screen. He found that his pulse rate had remained perfectly steady. He had no shortness of breath, no rubber legs. Death had become a normality.
Are you there, Mr. Richards?
Killian asked.
Yes, I am.
The problem has been handled.
Yes?
Good. Let me get back to what I was saying.
Go ahead.
Killian sighed at his tone.
I was saying that our knowledge of your bluff makes your position worse, but makes our credibility better. Do you see why?
Yes, Richard said detachedly. It means you could have blown this bird out of the sky any time, or you could have had Holloway set the plane down at will.
McCone would have bumped me.
Exactly. Do you believe we know you are bluffing?
No. But you're better than McCone. Using your planet houseboy was a fine stroke.
Killian laughed.
Oh, Richards, you are such a peach. Such a rare, iridescent bird.
And yet again, it sounded forced, tense, pressured. It came to Richards that Killian was holding information which he wanted badly not to tell.
If you really had it, you would have pulled the string when McCone put the gun to your head. You knew he was going to kill you. Yet you sat there.
Richards knew it was over. Knew that they knew. A smile cracked his features. Killian would appreciate that. He was a man of a sharp and sardonic turn of mind. Make them pay to see the whole card then.
I'm not buying any of this. If you push me, everything goes bang.
And you wouldn't be the man you are if you didn't spin it out to the very end. Mr. Donahue.
Yes, sir.
Donahue's cool, efficient, emotionless voice came over the voice comm and out of the freebie almost simultaneously.
Please go back and remove Mrs. Williams' pocketbook from Mr. Richards' pocket. You're not to harm him in any way.
Yes, sir.
Richards was eerily reminded of the plastic punch that had stenciled his original ID card at Games headquarters. Clitter, clitter, clitter. Donahue reappeared and walked towards Richards. His face was smooth and cold and empty. Programmed. The word leaped into Richards' mind.
Stand right there, pretty boy,
Richards remarked, shifting the hand in his coat pocket slightly.
The man there is safe on the ground. You're the one that's going to the moon.
He thought the steady stride might have faltered for just a second, and the eyes seemed to have winced the tiniest uncertain bit, and then he came on again. He might have been promenading on the Côte d'Azur, or approaching a gibbering homosexual cowering at the end of a blind alley. Briefly, Richards considered grabbing the parachute and fleeing.
Hopeless. Flee? Where?
The men's bathroom at the far end of the third class was the end of the line.
See you in hell, he said softly, and made a pulling gesture in his pocket.
This time the reaction was a little better. Donahue made a grunting noise and threw his hands up to protect his face in an instinctive gesture as old as man himself. He lowered them, still in the land of the living, looking embarrassed and very angry. Richards took Amelia Williams' pocketbook out of his muddy, torn coat pocket and threw it. It struck Donahue's chest and plopped at his feet like a dead bird. Richards' hand was slimed with sweat. Lying on his knee again, it looked strange and white and foreign. Donahue picked up the bag, looked in it perfunctorily, and handed it to Amelia. Richards felt a stupid sort of sadness at its passage. In a way, it was like losing an old friend. Boom, he said softly. -14, and counting.
Your boy's very good, Richard said tiredly, when Donahue had retreated again. I got him to flinch, but I was hoping he'd pee his pants.
He was beginning to notice an odd doubling of his vision. It came and went. He checked his side gingerly. It was clotting reluctantly for the second time.
What now? He asked. Do you set up cameras at the airport so everyone can watch the desperado get it? Now the deal,
Killian said softly. His face was dark, unreadable. Whatever he had been holding back was now just below the surface. Richards knew it. And suddenly he was filled with dread again. He wanted to reach out and turn the freebie off. Not hear it anymore. He felt his insides begin a slow and terrible quaking. An actual, literal quaking. But he could not turn it off. Of course not. It was, after all, free.
Get thee behind me, Satan, he said thickly.
What?
Killian looked startled.
Nothing. Make your point.
Killian did not speak. He looked down at his hands. He looked up again. Richards felt an unknown chamber of his mind groan with psychic presentiment. It seemed to him that the ghosts of the poor and the nameless, of the drunks sleeping in alleys, were calling his name.
McCone is played out,
Killian said softly.
You know it because you did it. Cracked him like a soft-shelled egg. We want you to take his place.
Richards, who thought he had passed the point of all shock, found his mouth hanging open in utter, dazed incredulity. It was a lie. Had to be. Yet, Amelia had her purse back now. There was no reason for them to lie or offer false illusions. He was hurt and alone. Both McCone and Donahue were armed. One bullet, administered just above the left ear, would put a neat end to him with no fuss, no muss, or bother. Conclusion? Killian was telling God's truth.
You're nuts, he muttered.
No. You are the best runner we've ever had, and the best runner knows the best places to look. Open your eyes a little, and you'll see that the running man is designed for something besides pleasuring the masses and getting rid of dangerous people. Richards, the network is always in the market for fresh, new talent. We have to be.
Richards tried to speak, could say nothing. The dread was still in him, widening, heightening, thickening.
There's never been a chief hunter with a family, he finally said.
You ought to know why. The possibilities for extortion,
Ben, Killian said with infinite gentleness. Your wife and daughter are dead. They've been dead for over 10 days.
-13, and counting.
Dan Killian was talking, had been perhaps for some time, but Richards heard him only distantly, distorted by an odd echo effect in his mind. It was like being trapped in a very deep well and hearing someone call down. His mind had gone midnight dark, and the darkness served as the background for a kind of scrapbook slideshow. An old Kodak of Sheila, wiggling in the halls of Trades High, with a loose-leaf binder under her arm. Microskirts had just come back into fashion then. A freeze frame of the two of them, sitting at the end of the bay pier, admission free, backs to the camera, looking out at the water, hands linked. Sepia-toned photo of a young man in an ill-fitting suit and a young woman in her mother's best dress. Specially taken up, standing before a J.P., with a large wart on his nose. They giggled at that wart on their wedding night. Stark black-and-white action photo of a sweating, bare-chested man wearing a lead apron and working heavy engine gear levers in a huge, vault-like underground chamber lit with arc lamps. Soft-tone color photo, soft to blur the stark, peeling surroundings, of a woman with a big belly standing at a window and looking out, ragged curtain held aside, watching for her man to come up the street. The light is a soft cat's paw on her cheek. Last picture. Another old-timey Kodak of a thin fellow holding a tiny scrap of a baby high over his head in a curious mixture of triumph and love, his face split by a huge winning grin. The pictures began to flash by faster and faster, whirling, not bringing any sense of grief and love and loss, not yet, no, bringing only a cool Novocaine numbness. Killian, assuring that the network had nothing to do with their deaths, all a horrible accident. Richard supposed he believed him, not only because the story sounded too much like a lie not to be the truth, but because Killian knew that if Richards agreed to the job offer, his first stop would be Co-op City, where a single hour on the streets would get him the straight of the matter. Prowlers. 3 of them. Or tricks, Richards wondered, suddenly agonized. She had sounded slightly furtive on the telephone, as if holding something back. They had been hopped up, probably.
Perhaps they had made some threatening move toward Kathy, and Sheila had tried to protect her daughter. They had both died of puncture wounds.
That had snapped him out of it.
Don't feed me that shit!
He screamed suddenly. Amelia flinched backward and suddenly hit her face.
What happened? Tell me what happened!
There's nothing more I can say.
Your wife was stabbed over 60 times.
Kathy, Richard said emptily, without thought, and Killian winced.
Ben, would you like some time to think about all this?
Yes. Yes, I would.
I'm desperately, desperately sorry, pal. I swear on my mother that we had nothing to do with it. Our way would have been to set them up away from you, with visiting rights if you agreed. A man doesn't willingly work for the people who butchered his family. We know that.
I need time to think.
As chief hunter, Killian said softly, you could get those bastards and put them down a deep hole, and a lot of others just like them.
I want to think. Goodbye.
I...
Richards reached out and thumbed the freebie into blackness. He sat stone-like in his seat. His hands dangled loosely between his knees. The plane droned on into darkness. So, he thought, it's all come unraveled. All of it. -12, and counting. An hour passed. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of sailing ships and sealing wax, and whether pigs have wings. Pictures flitted in and out of his mind. Stacy, Bradley, Elton Paracas with his baby face, a nightmare of running, lighting the newspapers in the basement of the YMCA with that last match. The gas-powered cars wheeling and screeching, the Sten gun spitting flame. Laughlin's sour voice. The pictures of those two kids, the junior Gestapo agents. Well, why not? No ties now, and certainly no morality. How could morality be an issue to a man cut loose and drifting? How wise Killian had been to see that, to show Richards with calm and gentle brutality just how alone he was. Bradley and his impassioned air pollution pitch seemed distant, unreal, unimportant. Nose filters. Yes. At one time, the concept of nose filters had seemed large, very important. No longer so. The poor you will have with you always. True. Even Richard's loins had produced a specimen for the killing machine. Eventually, the poor would adapt, mutate. Their lungs would produce their own filtration system in 10,000 years or in 50,000, and they would rise up, rip out the artificial filters, and watch their owners flop and kick and drum their lives away, drowning in an atmosphere where oxygen played only a minor part. And what was futurity to Ben Richards? It was only bitchin'. There would be a period of grief. They would expect that, provide for it. There would even be rages, moments of revolt, abortive tries to make the knowledge of deliberate poison in the air public again? Maybe. They would take care of it. Take care of him. Anticipation of a time when he would take care of them. Instinctively, he knew he could do it. He suspected he might even have a certain genius for the job. They would help him, heal him. Drugs and doctors. A change of mind. Then peace. Contentiousness rooted out like bitter weed. He regarded the peace longingly, the way a man in the desert regards water. Amelia Williams cried steadily in her seat long after the time when all tears should have gone dry. He wondered indifferently what would become of her. She couldn't very well be returned to her husband and family in her present state. She simply was not the same lady who had pulled up to a routine stop sign, with her mind all full of meals and meetings, clubs and cooking. She had shown red. He supposed there would be drugs and therapy, a patient showing off. The place where two roads diverged, a pinpointing of the reason why the wrong path had been chosen, a carnival in dark mental browns. He wanted suddenly to go to her, comfort her, tell her that she was not badly broken, that a single crisscrossing of psychic band-aids should fix her, make her even better than she had been before. Sheila. Kathy. Their names came and repeated, clanging in his mind like bells, like words repeated until they are reduced to nonsense. Say your name over 200 times and discover you are no one. Grief was impossible. He could feel only a fuzzy sense of embarrassment. They had taken him, run him slack-lunged, and he had turned out to be nothing but a horse's ass after all. He remembered a boy from his grammar school days who had stood up to give the Pledge of Allegiance, and his pants had fallen down. The plane droned on and on. He sank into a three-quarter doze. Pictures came and went lazily. Whole incidents were seen without any emotional color at all. Then, a final scrapbook picture. A glossy 8x10, taken by a bored police photographer who had perhaps been chewing gum. Exhibit C, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. One ripped and sliced small body in a blood-drenched crib. Splatters and runnels on the cheap stucco walls and the broken Mother Goose mobile, bought for a dime. a great sticky clot on the second-hand teddy bear with one eye. He snapped awake, full awake and bolt upright, with his mouth propped wide in a blabbering scream. The force expelled from his lungs was great enough to make his tongue flap like a sail. Everything in the first-class compartment was suddenly clear and plangently real, overpowering, awful. It had the grainy reality of a scare tabloid newsy clip. Laughlin being dragged out of that shed in Topeka, for instance. Everything. Everything was very real and in technicolor. Amelia screamed affrightedly in unison, cringing back in her seat with eyes as huge as cracked porcelain doorknobs, trying to cram a whole fist in her mouth. Donahue came charging through the galley, his gun out. His eyes were small, enthusiastic black beads. "What is it? What's wrong? McCone?" "No," Richard said, feeling his heart slow just enough to keep his words from sounding squeezed and desperate. "Bad dream. My little girl." "Oh." Donahue's eyes softened in counterfeit sympathy. He didn't know how to do it very well. Perhaps he would be a goon all his life. Perhaps he would learn. He turned to go. "Donahue?" Donahue turned back warily. "Had you pretty scared, didn't I?" "No." Donahue turned away on that short word. His neck was bunched. His buttocks and his tight blue uniform were as pretty as a girl's. "I can scare you worse," Richards remarked. "I could threaten to take away your nose filter." Exuant Donahue. Richards closed his eyes tiredly. The glossy 8x10 came back. Opened them. Closed them. No glossy 8x10. He waited, and when he was sure it was not going to come back right away, he opened his eyes and thumbed on the freebie. It popped on, and there was Killian. -11, and counting.
"Richards."
Killian leaned forward, making no effort to conceal his tension. "I've decided to accept," Richard said. Killian leaned back and nothing smiled but his eyes.
"I'm very glad," he said.
-10, and counting.
"Jesus,"
Richard said. He was standing in the doorway to the pilot's country. Holloway turned around.
"Aye."
He'd been speaking to something called Detroit VOR. Doniger was drinking coffee. The twin control consoles were untended, yet they swerved, tipped, and turned as if in response to ghost hands and feet. Dials swung. Lights flashed. There seemed to be a huge and constant input and output going on. To no one at all.
"Who's driving the bus?" Richards asked, fascinated.
"Otto," Doniger said.
"Otto?"
"Otto, the automatic pilot? Get it? Shitty pun." Doniger suddenly smiled.
"Glad to have you on the team, fella. You may not believe this, but some of us guys were rooting for you pretty hard."
Richards nodded noncommittally. Holloway stepped into the slightly awkward breach by saying,
"Otto freaks me out, too. Even after 20 years of this. But he's dead safe. Sophisticated as hell. Could make one of the old ones look like, well, like an orange crate beside a Chippendale bureau. Is that right?"
Richards was staring out into the darkness.
"Yes. You lock on POD, the point of destination, and auto takes over. Aided by voice radar all the way. Makes the pilot pretty superfluous, except for takeoffs and landings. And in case of trouble."
"Is there much you can do if there's trouble?" Richards asked.
"We can pray,"
Holloway said. Perhaps it was meant to sound jocular, but it came out with a strange sincerity that hung in the cabin.
"Do those wheels actually steer the plane?" Richards asked.
"Only up and down," Doniger said. "The pedals control side-side motion."
"Sounds like a kid's soapbox racer." "A little more complicated," Holloway said. "Let's just say there are a few more buttons to push."
"What happens if Otto goes off his chump?"
"Never happens," Doniger said with a grin. "If it did, you just override him. But the computer is never wrong, pal."
Richards wanted to leave, but the sight of the turning wheels, the minute, mindless adjustments of the pedals and switches held him. Holloway and Dunniger went back to their business. Obscure numbers and communications filled with static. Holloway looked back once, seemed surprised to see him still there. He grinned and pointed into the darkness.
You'll see Harding coming up there soon.
How long?
You'll be able to see the horizon glow in 5 to 6 minutes.
When Holloway turned around next, Richards was gone. He said to Dunniger,
I'll be glad when we set that guy down. He's a spook.
Dunniger looked down morosely, his face bathed in the green, luminescent glow of the controls.
He didn't like Otto. You know that? I know it,
Holloway said. -9 and counting. Richards walked back down the narrow, hip-wide corridor. Friedman, the communications man, didn't look up. Neither did Donahue. Richards stepped through into the galley and then halted. The smell of coffee was strong and good. He poured himself a cup, added some instant creamer, and sat down in one of the stewardess's off-duty chairs. The Silex bubbled and steamed. There was a complete stock of luxury frozen dinners in the see-through freezers. The liquor cabinet was fully stocked with midget airline bottles.
A man could have a good drunk, he thought.
He sipped his coffee. It was strong and fine. The Silex bubbled.
Here I am, he thought, and sipped. Yes, no question about it.
Here he was, just sipping. Pots and pans, all neatly put away. The stainless steel sink, gleaming like a chromium jewel in a formica setting. And of course that Silex on the hot plate, bubbling and steaming. Sheila had always wanted a Silex. A Silex lasts, was her claim. He was weeping. There was a tiny toilet where only stewardess's bottoms had squatted. The door was half ajar and he could see it. Yes, even the blue, primly disinfected water in the bowl. Defecate in tasteful splendor at 50,000 feet. He drank his coffee and watched the Silex bubble and steam, and he wept. The weeping was very calm and completely silent. It and his cup of coffee ended at the same time. He got up and put his cup in the stainless steel sink. He picked up the Silex, holding it by its brown plastic handle, and carefully dumped the coffee down the drain. Tiny beads of condensation clung to the thick glass. He wiped his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket and went back into the narrow corridor. He stepped into Donahue's compartment, carrying the Silex in one hand. "Want some coffee?" Richards asked.
"No,"
Donahue said curtly, without looking up.
"Sure you do," Richards said, and swung the heavy glass pot down on Donahue's bent head with all the force he could manage.
-8 and counting. The effort ripped open the wound in his side for the third time, but the pot didn't break. Richards wondered if it had been fortified with something. Vitamin B12, perhaps? To keep it from shattering in case of high-level turbulence. It did take a huge, amazing blot of Donahue's blood. He fell silently onto his map table. A runnel of blood ran across the plastic coating of the top one and began to drip.
Roger, 5-by. C19084.
A radio voice said brightly. Richards was still holding the Silex. It was matted with strands of Donahue's hair. He dropped it, but there was no clunk, carpeting even here. The glass bubble of the Silex rolled up at him, a winking, bloodshot eyeball. The glossy 8x10 of Kathy in her crib appeared unbidden, and Richards shuddered. He lifted Donahue's dead weight by the hair and rummaged inside his blue flight jacket. The gun was there. He was about to drop Donahue's head back to the map table, but paused and yanked it up even further. Donahue's mouth hung unhinged, an idiot leer. Blood dripped into it. Richards wiped blood from one nostril and stared in. There it was. Tiny. Very tiny. A glitter of mesh.
Acknowledge ETA, C19084,
the radio said.
Hey, that's you!
Freeman called from across the hall.
Donahue!
Richards limped into the passage. He felt very weak. Freeman looked up.
Will you tell Donahue to get off his butt and acknowledge?
Richards shot him just above the upper lip. Teeth flew like a broken savage necklace. Hair, blood, and brains splashed a Rorschach on the wall behind the chair, where a 3D fold-out girl was spreading eternal legs over a varnished mahogany bedpost. There was a muffled exclamation from the pilot's compartment, and Holloway made a desperate, doomed lunge to shut the door. Richards noticed that he had a very small scar on his forehead, shaped like a question mark. It was the kind of scar a small, adventurous boy might get if he fell from a low branch while playing pilot. He shot Holloway in the belly, and Holloway made a great shocked noise. His feet flipped out from under him, and he fell on his face. Dunninger was turned around in his chair, his face a slack moon.
"Don't shoot me, huh?"
he said. There was not enough wind in him to make it a statement. "Here," Richard said kindly, and pulled the trigger. Something popped and flared with brief violence behind Dunninger as he fell over. Silence.
"Acknowledge ETA, C19084,"
the radio said. Richard suddenly whooped and threw up a great glut of coffee and bile. The muscular contraction ripped his wound open further, implanting a great throbbing pain in his side. He limped to the controls, still dipping and sliding an endless complex tandem. So many dials and controls. Wouldn't they have a communications link constantly open on such an important flight? Surely.
"Acknowledge," Richard said conversationally. "You got the freebie on up there, C19084? We've been getting some garbled transmission. Everything okay?"
"Five by,"
Richard said. "Tell Dunninger he owes me a beer," the voice said cryptically, and then there was only background static. Otto was driving the bus. Richards went back to finish his business. -7 and counting.
"Oh, dear God,"
Amelia Williams moaned. Richards looked down at himself casually. His entire right side, from ribcage to calf, was a bright and sparkling red. "Who would have thought the old man had so much blood in him?" Richard said. McCone suddenly dashed through into first class. He took in Richards at a glance. McCone's gun was out. He and Richards fired at the same time. McCone disappeared through the canvas between first and second class. Richard sat down hard. He felt very tired. There was a large hole in his belly. He could see his intestines. Amelia was screaming endlessly, her hands pulling her cheeks down into a plastic witch face. McCone came staggering back into first class. He was grinning. Half of his head appeared to be blown away, but he was grinning all the same. He fired twice. The first bullet went over Richard's head. The second struck him just below the collarbone. Richards fired again. McCone staggered around twice in an aimless kind of dipsy-doodle. The gun fell from his fingers. McCone appeared to be observing the heavy white styrofoam ceiling of the first-class compartment, perhaps comparing it to his own in second class. He fell over. The smell of burned powder and burned flesh was clear and crisp, as distinctive as apples in a cider press. Amelia continued to scream. Richards thought how remarkably healthy she sounded. -6 and counting. Richards got up very slowly, holding his intestines in. It felt as if someone was lighting matches in his stomach. He went slowly up the aisle, bent over, one hand to his midriff, as if bowing. He picked up the parachute with one hand and dragged it behind him. A loop of gray sausage escaped his fingers, and he pushed it back in. It hurt to push it in. It vaguely felt as if he might be shitting himself. Amelia Williams was groaning.
God! Oh, God! Oh, dear God!
"Put this on,"
Richard said. She continued to rock and moan, not hearing him. He dropped the parachute and slapped her. He could get no force into it. He balled his fist and punched her. She shut up. Her eyes stared at him dazedly.
"Put this on," he said again. "Like a pack sack. You see how?"
She nodded.
"I can't jump. Scared."
"We're going down. You have to jump."
"Can't."
"All right. Shoot you then."
She popped out of her seat, knocking him sideways, and began to pull the pack sack on with wild, eye-rolling vigor. She backed away from him as she struggled with the straps.
"No, that one goes under."
She rearranged the strap with great speed, retreating toward McCone's body as Richards approached. Blood was dripping from his mouth.
"Now fasten the clip in the ring bolt around your belly."
She did it with trembling fingers, weeping when she missed the connection the first time. Her eyes stared madly into his face. She skittered momentarily in McCone's blood, then stepped over him. They backed through second class and into third class in the same way. Matches in his belly had been replaced by a steadily flaming lighter. The emergency door was locked with explosive bolts and a pilot-controlled bar. Richards handed her the gun.
"Shoot it. I can't take the recoil."
Closing her eyes and averting her face, she pulled the trigger of Donahue's gun twice. Then it was empty. The door stood closed, and Richards felt a faint, sick despair. Amelia Williams was holding the ripcord ring nervously, giving it tiny little twitches.
"Maybe,"
she began, and the door suddenly blew away into the night, sucking her along with it. -5, and counting. Bent hag-like, a man in a reverse hurricane, Richards made his way from the blown door, holding the backs of seats. If they had been flying higher, with a greater difference in air pressure, he would have been pulled out too. As it was, he was being badly buffeted, his pearled intestines accordioning out and trailing after him on the floor. The cool night air, thin and sharp at 2,000 feet, was like a slap of cold water. The cigarette lighter had become a torch, and his insides were burning. Through second class. Better? Suction not so great. Now over McCone's sprawled body. "Step up, please," and through first class. Blood ran loosely from his mouth. He paused at the entrance to the galley and tried to gather up his intestines. He knew they didn't like it on the outside. Not a bit. They were getting all dirty. He wanted to weep for his poor, fragile intestines who had asked for none of this. He couldn't pack them back inside. It was all wrong. They were all jumbled. Frightening images from high school biology books jetted past his eyes. He realized with dawning, stumbling truth the fact of his own actual ending and cried out miserably through a mouthful of blood. There was no answer from the aircraft. Everyone was gone. Everyone but himself and Otto. The world seemed to be draining of color, as his body drained of its own bright fluid. Leaning crookedly against the galley entrance, like a drunk leaning against a lamppost, he saw the things around him go through a shifting, wraith-like gray out.
"This is it. I'm going."
He screamed again, bringing the world back into excruciating focus. "Not yet. Mustn't." He lunged through the galley with his guts hanging in ropes around him. Amazing that there could be so much in there. So round, so firm, so fully packed. He stepped on part of himself, and something inside pulled. The flare of pain was beyond belief, beyond the world, and he shrieked, splattering blood on the far wall. He lost his balance and would have fallen, had not the wall stopped him at 60 degrees.
"Gutshot. I'm gutshot."
Insanely, his mind responded, clitter, clitter, clitter. One thing to do. Gutshot was supposed to be one of the worst. They had had a discussion once about the worst ways to go on their midnight lunch break. That had been when he was a wiper. Hale and hearty and full of blood and piss and semen, all of them, gobbling sandwiches and comparing the relative merits of radiation poisoning, freezing, falling, bludgeoning, drowning. And someone had mentioned being gutshot. Harris, maybe. The fat one who drank illicit beer on the job.
It hurts in the belly, Harris said. It takes a long time.
And all of them nodding and agreeing solemnly, with no conception of pain. Richards lurched up the narrow corridor, holding both sides for support, past Donahue, past Friedman and his radical dental surgery, numbness crawling up his arms, yet the pain in his belly, what had been his belly, growing worse. Still, even through all this he moved, and his ruptured body tried to carry out the commands of the insane Napoleon caged inside his skull. My God, can this be the end of Rico? He would not have believed he had so many deathbed cliches inside him. It seemed that his mind was turning inward, eating itself in its last fevered seconds. One more thing. He fell over Holloway's sprawled body and lay there suddenly sleepy. A nap? Yes, just the ticket. Too hard to get up. Auto humming, singing the birthday boy to sleep. The sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. He lifted his head. Tremendous effort. His head was steel, pig iron, lead, and stared at the twin controls going through their dance. Beyond him, in the plexiglass windows, Harding. Too far. He's under the haystack, fast asleep. -4, and counting. The radio was squawking worriedly.
Come in, C-19-84. You're too low. Acknowledge. Acknowledge. Shall we assume guidance control? Acknowledge. Acknowledge.
Eat it, Richards whispered. He began to crawl toward the dipping, swaying controls. In and out went the pedals. Twitch, twitch went the wheels. He screamed as new agony flared. A loop of his intestines had caught under Holloway's chin. He crawled back, freed them, started to crawl again. His arms went slack, and for a moment he floated, weightless, with his nose in the soft, deep pile carpet. He pushed himself up and began to crawl again. Getting up and at Holloway's seat was Everest. -3, and counting. There it was. Huge, bulking, square, and tall into the night, silhouetted black above everything else. Moonlight had turned it alabaster. He tweaked the wheel just a little. The floor fell away to the left. He lurched in Holloway's seat and almost fell out. He turned the wheel back, overcorrected again, and the floor fell away to the right. The horizon was tilting crazily. Now the pedals. Yes. Better. He pushed the wheel in gingerly. A dial in front of his eyes moved from 2,000 to 1,500 in the wink of an eye. He eased the wheel back. He had very little sight left. His right eye was almost completely gone. Strange that they should go one at a time. He pushed the wheel in again. Now it seemed that the plane was floating, weightless. The dial slipped from 1,500 to 1,200 to 900. He pulled it back out.
C-19-84. The voice was very alarmed now. What's wrong? Acknowledge.
Speak, boy, Richards croaked.
Roof! Roof!
-2, and counting. The big plane cruised through the night like a sliver of ice, and now Co-op City was spread out below like a giant broken carton. He was coming at it. Coming at the games building. -1, and counting. Now the jet cruised across the canal, seemingly held up by the hand of God, giant, roaring. A push freak in a doorway stared up and thought he was seeing a hallucination, the last dope dream come to take him away, perhaps to General Atomic's heaven, where all the food was free and all the piles were clean breeders. The sound of its engines drove people into doorways, their faces craning upwards like pale flames. Glass show windows jingled and fell inward. Gutter litter was sucked down bowling alley streets and dervishes. A cop dropped his move along and wrapped his hands around his head and screamed and could not hear himself. The plane was still dropping, and now it moved over rooftops like a cruising silver bat. The starboard wingtip missed the side of the Glamour Column store by a bare 12 feet. All over Harding, freebies went white with interference, and people stared at them with stupid, fearful incredulity. The thunder filled the world. Killian looked up from his desk and stared into the wall-to-wall window that formed one entire side of the room. The twinkling vista of the city, from South City to Crescent, was gone. The entire window was filled with an oncoming Lockheed TriStar jet. Its running lights blinked on and off, and for just a moment, an insane moment of total surprise and horror and disbelief, he could see Richards staring out at him. His face smeared with blood, his black eyes burning like the eyes of a demon. Richards was grinning and giving him the finger. Jesus! Was all Killian had time to get out. Minus zero, and counting. Heeling over slightly, the Lockheed struck the Games building dead on, three-quarters of the way up. Its tanks were still better than a quarter full. Its speed was slightly over 500 miles an hour. The explosion was tremendous, lighting up the night like the wrath of God. And it rained fire 20 blocks away. This concludes the reading of The Running Man by Stephen King, writing as Richard Bachman.